You are listening to WPVMLP 103.7 in Asheville, North Carolina.
Here's your Radio Asheville weather report. Plenty of sunshine across the mountains today, a high near 71 here in town. Partly cloudy tonight, the low dropping to around 47. Mostly sunny on Saturday. There is a slight chance of showers around midday, a high near 77. Partly cloudy for Saturday night, the low around 51. More showers possible on Sunday, maybe a rumble of thunder with a high near 79. I'm Johnny Cottle on Radio Asheville, 103.7.
Welcome to Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I'm your host, James Nave. Today, my guest is Diana Gustafson. Diana and I sat down for a conversation after Allegra Houston and I finished facilitating our week-long writing workshop in Taos the last week of April. I was very intrigued with much of the things Diana had to say during the workshop, and I thought having a conversation with her would be something I would enjoy, and she would too, and hopefully you as well. Diana is an Episcopal priest. She's a writer. She's working on a memoir. Writing is part of her life. She came to our workshop just to juice things up a bit, to get some inspiration, talk with other people about the strategies around how she wants to move forward with her memoir and other writing. So during the week, very enlightening conversations between the two of us, as well as the other members of our group. So I sat down a couple of days after the workshop was over, and Diana and I had this conversation. So we began by talking about the experiences she had in the workshop, and we move on from there to Adam and Eve, wholeness, what God means, does God exist? Very, very good conversation, I have to say. So let's turn to the conversation now, and you will discover where we went during the hour that we sat on a couch at Allegra Houston's house and just had a conversation. Here you go. So Diana, you and I are sitting in a little room that belongs to my creative collaborator, Allegra Houston, and you and I just spent the last week working in a group of writers in Taos at the Taos Imaginative Storm Writing Workshop. And I just love the exchange that we had. Mm-hmm. Very smart, very quick, fast, to the point.
Yeah.
Fantastic. I'd like for you to just reflect on how you are feeling right now at the end of this process. Well, what's going on with you as a writer? And tell us a bit about who you are and what you're about and fit that into the story of how you're feeling right now.
Well, I came to this because I had left Washington, D.C. just about a year ago, where I was a priest in an Episcopal church. And I was exhausted. And I gave myself 9 months to just do nothing but hike and hang out with my husband and buy a house. And then I wanted to get back to something I've always wanted to do, which I've done part-time here and there, which was to write. And I was not actually particularly thinking of writing memoir, although that's what you and I and Allegra ended up talking about. I was also thinking about doing creative nonfiction essays, which connected to my writing of sermons. And my sermon writing and my sermon preaching has always been the pulling together of an idea, which originates in whatever the Bible piece is, the Testament piece is of that week, with stories. And usually stories from my life or stories from my childhood that make that idea real, that bring it alive, that people who are listening connect to. And I wanted to do something like that, that was no longer preaching, that was creative nonfiction essay writing, but to a much wider, not particularly religious audience, but had some of that same feel. And then the memoir came about because I was telling so many of these stories of childhood, and they seemed to me, to seem really powerful. I saw a class in Grant Magazine and you had to write a piece of memoir to get into the class. I didn't ever get into the class, but I spent 3 weeks writing this 1,200-word piece. And the putting together of ideas from my, of experiences from my childhood, just made the ideas real. I began to understand things. They began to come together. I think I'd already signed up for the workshop with you and Allegra at that point. But then I began to be really excited, like, oh, okay, it didn't get accepted. I have no idea how much talent I have. I've been writing all my life, but how do I get empowered to do it, to do the writing that I want to do? And so then I took the workshop. I loved the workshop. I felt creatively and intellectually engaged every day. And there are two things I loved about it that we were talking, you and I were talking about with Allegra this morning. One was the connection to the people in the workshop who were honest and real and just did not have any chips on their shoulders. They were just there and present, supportive. And I felt like, oh my goodness, this is what I wish were true about all my female, and Mark too, but all my female friends, that it could be this intense and this supportive. And you and Allegra, I think, create that. You bring that together for people, and then people feed into your energy, which is so loving and kind and supportive, and then they can create out of that. The second thing was the creativity that came out of it. And I'm writing and writing and writing, and I've also sent Allegra this piece that got turned down by Granta, and then she and I meet, and she says, well, you know, I think it's actually kind of dead. And I'm like, what? It can't be dead. And she said, well, yeah, it is kind of. And so then I go back, and I'm like so depressed, and I don't know what to do with myself. And I talk to you, and you kind of buck me up and say, well, that can't be right. And then you talk to Allegra anyway. Then I get this feedback that, like, oh, but you have so much energy and insight, and you can use it to make this alive. And you, your writing should be alive, because there is aliveness and certainty and connection in all the writing you've been doing in the workshop. And that's where your memoir is going to come from. So those are the two things that I experienced this past week, was the humans, for me, sister connection, and then the connection with you and Allegra. And then the other part would be, oh, okay, I have a road now. I have a technique that I can use that we've been practicing all week that I know generates stuff in me. So I'd say that's what I walked away with.
You mentioned a moment ago that you've been writing all your life, but you didn't know how much talent you had.
I mean, you're assuming that I do.
I'm asking you to reflect on that a bit and reflect on what talent means to you. I'm assuming we all have talent. We would be unable to survive if we didn't. So when you say you don't know how much talent you've had, and yet you report, I've been writing all my life. So you must suspect there's something there, talent-wise. Can you reflect on what that suspicion might be, and where you want to go with that?
Well, there's several things I get out of writing. One of them is I get lost in what I'm doing. It's a little bit like a drug. You're just subsumed into it. The second is when it works, it's like you've captured something. Like you've created that ball of amber, and something is in it, and it's something that connects me as a writer more deeply to the world, because I've been able to somehow crystallize or say what I've wanted to say. I love beautiful writing. I mean, we've talked a lot about Ocean Vaughan. I just read Flesh, by the Hungarian-American writer, I'm forgetting his name, but both of them create a world. They create a world with language and pictures and a deep connection to the world that I have experienced, and yet they're creating their own world, and they do it with gorgeous language. And those two writers do it very differently, but they're both building a sensibility. And to me, that's what talent allows, is building that world, building that sensitivity, pulling people in with the flow and the conciseness of your language, just the beauty of the language. I majored in American poetry in college. And so part of it is just that poetry of language. So that's talent. That's talent.
You said what talent allows. Mm-hmm. What talent allows suggests permission. I wonder if it's not about talent, because we have a lot of it, if it's about appreciating this range that we have and giving yourself permission to indulge it. Could this be more about the indulgence of the talent that you already have? I'm going to really indulge this. I'm going to give myself permission to indulge something that I know is there, and I've known it all along. I don't know what it'll do for me. I don't quite know what it is. Don't quite know exactly how to describe it, but I can feel it.
Yes. I grew up in a family with 6 girls, and we were very competitive with each other, in the way that children are for their parents' attention. And I think that is something that's innate in me, or has come about because of that upbringing, where I'm as much focused on how do I get to the top of the heap? How do I be the best? Rather than that voice, that desire to create and write, which is there, and that's something really different from being better or being the best or having your parents say, oh my God, Diana, you're such a great writer. I had a sister who is an artist, and people were astounded with her ability. And so you want that, and you grow up wanting that. And that's, I think, really different from feeling a connection to the voice that's in you, to feeling the connection to voice within you sounds not right. It's almost more like the volcano that's within you, like allowing that volcano that's within you up and out onto the page. Just, yeah.
I love the idea of the volcano instead of the voice.
Right.
So the voice becomes what broadcasts the information the volcano produces.
Yes.
Very different thing. Mm-hmm. So people say, I want to find my voice. Perhaps we should start saying, I want to find my volcano.
Yes. Yes.
And then my voice will be fine. The volcano is what I'm looking for.
Right.
The deep essence of going down, down, down into the earth. Mm-hmm. Our feet are planted on the earth. The gravity is pulling us down. Where is the volcano? I have another question that just popped up. What in your work, your thinking, all of this rolling around you've been doing for the last many, many years over a long arc of careers and exploration of the world, what now do you have that you want me to learn, that you can teach me? What do you have to offer me, and me being all of the listeners out there, not just Nave?
Well, because I'm a priest, I think in terms of the divine, and I think in terms of a God who loves and holds you. And what I want for each person, regardless of whether they're writing or not, although I think this can be a key to writing, is hearing how God is speaking to them, and feeling that they are contained and held within the divine, and that their power, their ability to connect with the world will come up out of that. And that God will hold, the divine God will hold them in that. And that that's what God most desires for them, to see the seed, the seed that God has planted within them come up and flower and be real and be something that is a way into the world, but isn't a way into the universe. So that's what I think one of the things I wish for people.
Good wish. Some people out there would say, when I hear the word God, it upsets me. It triggers me. It undoes me. I don't believe in God. I'm an atheist, or I'm a blank. You're talking about something collectively shared amongst all of us, mm-hmm. that many people, even if they say I'm an atheist or I don't believe in God, will quickly tell you something moves me, something entices me, something that seems beyond me delights me. Mm-hmm. I hear the word atheist a lot. People say I'm an atheist. I suppose I am an atheist in the sense that I don't believe God sits somewhere on a chair. But I do believe there's something mysterious out there pushing these leaves out in the spring and telling the leaves in the fall to close down shop and fall to the ground and become nourishment for the plants that will grow the next spring. Reflect on that sensibility from the broader point of view of how I'm attempting to define God in ways that will allow people listening who might not believe in the more traditional view of God can embrace the sensibilities that you're offering up.
Well, first, I think God is a very scary word for a lot of people. And second, I don't believe in a white-haired guy with a long beard sitting in judgment. I think a lot of people are scared of God as judgment, sitting in judgment. I came up as a priest through the Episcopal Church, but I think this is true of many faiths and religions, and even people who are not particularly faithful or religious, that God is a lover of us, that God desires wholeness for us, that what you see with the leaves sprouting in the spring and falling in the autumn is part of a wholeness, and that God desires that same wholeness for us. You don't have to use the word God. You can use the word divine. People say the universe does this or that. Maybe it is the universe, or God is the universe. But I think that there is a bigness to my understanding of God that gets made small and gets squished into a box by what many people's understanding of religion is. And that if we were able to let God, the divine imagination, strength, desire out of that box, then we might have more of, at least how I conceptualize God.
Often you hear people say, the power of the Lord moves through me. I grew up in Asheville. Mm-hmm. I went to Sardis Methodist Church on the corner of Sardis Road and Brevard Road. For those of you who are listening in Asheville, you know maybe where that is. It's just past where I-26 goes under Brevard Road. The power of the Lord will move through you. Power. Mm-hmm. I heard that. I hear that word used so much in relationship to whatever divinity will do to each mm-hmm. of us. It comes back as part of the report. You grew up in Washington, D.C., the center of
power.
Power, earthbound power. I'd like for you to reflect on the difference between what you came to understand in that arena of power in Washington, it's still there, just different people are there, but the power dynamic exists. The power that you learned, you knew then, and the power that you understand now, reflect on that. Help us understand the differences between those two, or how we need to understand both in order to embrace our own strengths.
Yeah, a lot of people do talk about the power of the Lord, and I think that can be really fulfilling for them, but it can also be very frightening to people who don't understand what that's about. I think that the power, the secular power, Washington, D.C. is certainly a place where people struggle and desire and lust for power. It used to be said about Washington, I'm not sure it's true so much, but when I was growing up, that people didn't necessarily have a lot of money. What they traded in for making big bucks was access, and access is power. And power is the ability to feel strong and better than other people, or be able to control what other people do. The kind of power that I'm talking about is one in which you were invited to be, I was going to say part of the universe, but that feels a little bit namby-pamby to me. I think you tap into the power that is of the universe. I do a lot of Tibetan meditation, and one of the things that we focus on is understanding that your concept of self and who you are is just a screen. It's not real in the sense that it's a screen. It's how you understand and are taught to engage with the world. But underneath, there's oneness, there's a greater power, and that it's not that you engage in that power, but that you slip into becoming part of that power. That it's a larger, and maybe power is not the right word, it's a larger, greater oneness and universe. And fear can slip away, can fall away. A sense of not knowing who you are can slip and fall away as you begin to let go of certain things and engage more deeply with other things, in this case, through meditation or prayer. I mean, I think Christians or Jews or Muslims, Hindus, all can have this experience. But I think that's also something similar. There's something mystical, maybe, about writing, where you also enter into that fecund, fertile space that is not the power of the Lord moving through you, although, yeah, maybe it is the power of the Lord moving through you. James McBride talks a lot about this in his books. He does it a lot in terms of Black culture, but he also, like, he feels it. His characters feel that in all sorts of different ways. And so I think that's the kind of power I'm talking about.
When you put your sermons together, and then when you write material that's not your sermons, how does the relationship between questions and answers factor in? When I come to a church service, I'm looking for answers. Maybe the answers come by way of questions you ask. But the question, the answer, the mystery, the magic, the transformations all built into that. In the sermon, if you've ever been to church, you know what a sermon is. If you've never been to church, well, you've probably heard somebody preach somewhere. And people who do preach do have a bit of power coming through them. They feel it somehow, or at least you hope so. Sometimes you have a bit of a dud.
Sometimes you go to sleep.
But sometimes you have a dud. But I've heard some pretty good holding forth. Questions and answers. Reflect on how those two ideas dance around in what you're trying to do creatively.
So when I preach, I'm usually starting with a text. So some piece of the New Testament. It could be the Old Testament. But let's say I'm talking about Genesis, the Old Testament, and about the Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. So that's my text. And then I'm just spending a lot of time thinking about it and seeing what other people have said about it and going really deeply into the material of Genesis, of what Adam and Eve did, what it felt like for them to suddenly feel like they were naked, what it felt like to them to understand that they were doing something that was not pleasing to God and maybe wasn't pleasing to themselves anymore. And then from that, those questions that I put to the text, like, what was Eve thinking? What was Adam thinking? What was their relationship to God? Then I come up with an idea that I want to draw people into, to give them insight into that story of Adam and Eve. And I will begin to build out this idea. And I may use stories from my own life or stories from other people's lives to see how they are connected to Adam and Eve and to the fall, maybe how they've fallen or been lifted up in their lives. And that will expand their idea of what it was like to be Adam or Eve. In other words, what it was like to disappoint a parental figure. That would be the sermon. The people would walk out, oh, I have a better idea of what Genesis is, but I also have a better idea of how it relates to me and how I am in the world. So when I'm writing creatively, I don't have a text to respond to in that way. The text that I'm providing is how I've lived in the world. And so I have to spend more time creating that story and how it might be real to you, who has a very different sensibility from me. So if I just tell that story plain, I may be very surprised by how much you actually say, oh, I experienced that, or oh, I can see exactly what you're talking about before my eyes, in my imagination. So once I do that, what feeling or idea or sensibility do I want to express and give you that will change how you understand yourself in the world and how you understand things that have happened to you? And, you know, we all have a lot in common, actually. So let's say I'm writing a story about someone who has an affair and they're trying to hide it from their husband and they feel that they have deeply hurt this person whom they love and who formed them as an adult, but they can't let go of this excitement. So in a sense, they have fallen. How do they get back to wholeness? So I might just tell you a story and not mention any of those things. But you, through experiencing that person's sense of love and regret and excitement, will begin to feel what it is to have done harm and to have, in a sense, hurt love. And then you will have to come out of that in some way and resolve it. And that will give you a sense of the resolution that might be in your life. And I don't mean the fiction. I don't want to make the story sound like it's self-help. But I think in some ways, all stories are self-help in the sense that we understand ourselves differently.
I'm sitting here thinking of going to Sardis Methodist Church, and I was introduced to the Adam and Eve story. I know it. I haven't studied the Bible deeply, but I was exposed to it for many, many years. So I'm sitting here thinking about the story now and what I understand of it. Snake entices Eve, and here's the apple, and she eats the apple, and then she's revealed. All these things are revealed to her. It seems to me that everything that Eve and Adam learned or saw or found by way of the sweet fruit, the apple, there wasn't much negative about it. It was all, from what I understand, you know, desire and, you know, the pleasures of the flesh and all of the things that make the human human, that gives us the range of our ability to tell our stories. Thank goodness Adam and Eve ate the apple. I'd never be a writer if they hadn't chewed a little bit on the core, if you know what I mean. So everything they were given, in my way of seeing, that's positive stuff. Great. I'm glad I have it. Now I have a range. Now I'm now engaged as a human being. So to me, it seems like the wisdom of Adam and Eve was somehow that discovery of what made them delightful, fantastic, breathing, thinking humans like we are, disappointed God. Mm-hmm. So they were they felt shame because they disappointed God, and maybe they discovered all of these delights on their own, which weren't negative. But for some reason, they were pitched the idea that these things are negative. So God pitches the idea that these things are negative. You have disappointed me, and now you have fallen. Perhaps God was disappointed because they rose rather than fell into a destiny that we're still exploring as writers and creatives.
Sure, you could make that argument. I don't think it's a wrong argument. I don't know why God would be disappointed in the fact that they rose, although God goes through the Bible doing that, if you think of the Tower of Babel. But I think more just directly from the gospel story, from the Old Testament story, they experience shame, they experience being ostracized, they experience, God says to women, woman, to Eve, you will experience the pains of childbirth and death. And one of the things God says to Eve is that you will always be dependent upon man, upon Adam. Personally, as a woman, I find that actually, that concept really painful. God says to Adam, you will have to work, you will sweat, you will bleed to make your way, to sustain your life. Those are really hard things. Do we want to suffer in that way? Yeah, so they got a lot out of it. And, you know, in quotes, they came to understand the difference between good and evil. They came to understand that they were more powerful than they knew. But they also were estranged from that thing which they most loved, which was a sense of wholeness.
And we could look around the world and see there's a lot of disruption right now. Mm-hmm. Has anybody ever written a story about what would have happened to the world, all 8 billion of us, had Adam and Eve stayed in the garden? Would we have been human?
Well, see, I don't know that God... I mean, obviously, I can't speak for God, but...
Well, why not? Go ahead.
I don't know that God didn't know that they were going to take the apple. I mean, God made it pretty easy for them to get the apple. I think Eve doesn't get enough credit for being smart enough to figure out what was going on. She gets blamed for an awful lot. But that's a side story. What if they had never bitten into the apple? What would have happened to the snake, to Satan? Satan would have, I don't know, would Satan have kept coming back? Would it be, maybe there's another dimension. Maybe there's a 13th dimension where Adam and Eve haven't eaten the apple. And they're going on living in the Garden of Eden.
Well, had they not eaten the apple and stayed in the garden, we would not have the range we have as we do in a human, from a human point of view. Mm-hmm. Now, that could be argued as good and bad and suffer and pain and joy and all of the things that drive us. I've not really even thought about Adam and Eve in quite a while, because I've never really felt particularly shamed by the things I've done wrong. I've never felt like any of the sins that I have perpetrated, and God knows I'm not sitting on a pedestal here, I've never felt the need for any forgiveness. I've never felt the need to feel anything other than, okay, I blew it. That was definitely, if you measured against how people measure sin, you know, I walked a little bit on the dark side. Okay, fine. History, I'm moving on. So I'm trying to get my head around the notion of why it's been that story has been with us the way it's been with us for so long, and why it's stuck with us from the point of view of you did bad and now you're being punished, we're going to kick you out. Mm-hmm. I find that offensive.
You find that offensive?
Actually, I haven't thought about it till just now, but it just does not seem like the way what I observe in the world around me, it doesn't seem like that's, seems like it's a little off tone.
Well, I mean, think about what happened with the second generation. Cain kills Abel. He's jealous. The blood speaks from the ground. And then look at where we are right now and the number of people murdering each other and the threat of nuclear destruction looming over us. And I'm very happy for you that you don't feel shame. But I think a lot of people do.
I know they do. I mean, I'm not saying I don't feel some shame. I've blown a few things. I just don't feel the need to have too much forgiveness for my sins.
Mm-hmm. But I don't think forgiveness ultimately is someone saying, oh, it's okay. It's not your mom or your dad saying, oh, I forgive you. You can let's go get an ice cream cone. I think true forgiveness is when you feel whole. It's when, so there's this concept in more in the Eastern Church, Eastern Christian Church, dating back, almost 2000 years ago, that to sin means to miss the mark, like you're shooting an arrow at a target and you miss the mark. And another way of saying that is you are no longer connected to the source of life and being in love. So what Adam and Eve did, if we were to say they sinned, they missed the mark. They were no longer plugged into that source of love and intelligence and innovation, and they were sucked down into a sort of pit of despair. Many the Judaism refers to hell as the pit, and that's what we can get sucked down into. For Christians, the second part of the story is that Jesus comes along, and Jesus says, oh my God, I see all this suffering and the ways in which you all are separating yourselves from God. And I'm here to tell you that God loves you, and God will show how much he loves you, that I'm going to take all that pain and put it on myself so you can be freed up a little bit to feel the love and connection to wholeness. And that's, in some ways, what creativity and writing is about. It provides us a way into connection to other human beings, into the energy of the world, into beauty. For people who love music, you can feel it, that music. For people who, all the different art forms, I think, do that.
You've given me a bit of insight here. I don't really feel the need to be forgiven for my sins. I've sinned, I've done good, I've done bad, all of that. Wholeness, though.
Yeah.
I understand that, Diana. I understand what that means. And I can tell you that I don't feel whole. I feel sometimes whole.
What makes you feel whole?
When I sit in the morning and drink a cup of coffee and just look out the window, mm-hmm. in a sense of being relaxed without any kind of imposed agenda, the to-dos of the day.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if I will ever feel whole. I wonder, perhaps I will feel the longing for being whole. Mm-hmm. And I know what sometimes it feels like to have that fullness. That might not be totally whole, but I love the idea of thinking of divinity, of God, of the universe as a place of wholeness, mm-hmm. that we can actually feel. I get it. If Adam and Eve ate the apple and then somehow it diminished their sense of being in the harmony of things.
Yes, exactly.
Then the loss of the garden was the loss of that sense of harmony.
Right.
So when I look outside and see the blackbirds here in Taos are coming back, they're going to build a nest in the ivy around here. And they come back almost every year about the same time. Mm-hmm. End of April, 1st of May, they're here chasing me around because they don't like me being around them. That's a sense of wholeness.
So you recite poetry brilliantly. You've read a lot of poetry. You've read a lot of great fiction. Does that ever bring you into wholeness when you're reading it, when you're reciting it, when you're creating it?
When I was a boy, my mother would say to me, and I've said this many times on this show, and if you've listened before, you've heard me say it. She would say, "You are a part of all that you have met. Mm-hmm. Yet all experience is an arch, where through gleams that untraveled world, whose margin fades forever and forever as you move." Ulysses, by Lord Tennyson. "The horizon fades forever and forever as you move." I may never feel the total wholeness, but I feel a completeness, mm-hmm. knowing I'm going toward the horizon with the sense of questing for a relationship with the wholeness that is out there.
And what is Tennyson's or Ulysses' connection to you and that wholeness?
Well, Tennyson's Ulysses, the sailor, comes back from right. the journey.
Finds Penelope and blah, blah, blah.
He's king, and you know, but he's not that happy with his kingdom. He's not even interested in the kingdom. He wants to go back out on the sea.
And, yeah.
You know, there lies the port. The vessel puffs her sails. There gloom the dark, broad seas. Mm-hmm. My mariner souls who toiled and thought and wrought with me, that ever with a frolic welcome touched the thunder and the sunshine and opposed free foreheads, free hearts. You and I are old age hath yet his honor and his toil. Yet something ere the end, some noble note, yet not unbecoming ones who strove with gods.
So there's this
quest to. So maybe that's the lack of wholeness, and maybe I don't want wholeness. Maybe I want the quest.
Yeah, could be. So you are questing toward
something
wholeness, toward God, toward. I mean, then think of Homer, whoever Homer was. You know, if we're going to go back to the original Odysseus, who's suffered through the Trojan War, who didn't want to go there in the first place, goes out and then has a delicious time, spending 10 years, whatever it is, coming back to Penelope and his now grown son. And where, like, we still know this poem how many thousands of years later, and we still relate to it. And I just began to read Emily Wilson's new translation of it. And I feel something when I read it. I feel connected to my childhood in the sense that I read it, you know, originally read the Iliad and the Odyssey then, but I also feel connected to a truth and a wholeness in the world. I feel like Odysseus is me making his way into the world, and whether Circe is coming up or whether he's fighting off the men who are trying to take over his kingdom, I feel that I am in him and he is in me in a way that just makes the world bigger and broader and alive. And I can feel connected to God in reading Homer. And Homer's God is not my God, but we both know God, I think. Or we know divinity, or we know wholeness.
I wonder if we are all whole, fully whole, because the universe, divinity, mm-hmm. is whole.
We I are think contained. That that's right.
We are contained in wholeness. Now, mm-hmm. lame as I am, I'm still trying to go to the horizon and feel it all. I'm looking, I'm searching in this wholeness that's already there that I don't really have to search for, but I want to feel more of it. So it may not be that I will be ever whole, but what I can do is feel more and more into the wholeness that I already am.
Absolutely. And I think that's a lot of what Buddhist, and in my case, my studies, Tibetan meditation is about. It's understanding not only is it there wholeness outside of us, but that eternity, that fullness, that oneness exists within us. That it's a matter of pulling those things that we desire and those things that hurt us aside so that we can see it. And I think in some ways that's what the artist wants to achieve. And it may be just through one little piece of a story. But I think it's like an arrow, and we are launched by that arrow that is the writer's pen into a piece of wholeness.
I couldn't agree more. You've given me an aha insight here. You started out talking about how you want the work to be excellent. I want my work to be excellent. If in fact what we're doing is exploring the excellence of wholeness, if wholeness isn't excellent, I don't know what is. It's like it's fantastic, right? So for us to strive for some kind of human qualification around what excellence means, what you know, I'm going to be published, I'm going to be the bestseller, mm-hmm. I'm going to have my name recognized as the poet. Look at me on Times Square, wherever it is. I'm a marquee now. Fine. But that's small potatoes mm-hmm. compared to this thing, what we're talking about now. So even somebody who's just having an inkling of something that we call artistic, which is this need to explore mm-hmm. into something that's already there for them, then it takes away that pressure of having the excellence that's measured by the academy. Mm-hmm. Not to say that it wouldn't be. And not to say that I wouldn't like it if I did something that somebody recognized. We all love to be loved and recognized. Right. This is something else.
Yes.
And there's a love that we're moving into, the love of wholeness. Wholeness is the unconditional love of existence that we are in. As we explore that in our own way, we are transformed each time we do it. Good or bad writing, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. terrible drawings, stick figures, the Mona Lisa, whatever it is. We're all participating equally in the same largesse.
So I'm thinking, I'm going back to this idea of power. And I'm also going back to, what did you say came up out of the Methodist Church?
Power of the Lord.
Power of the Lord.
The power of the Lord moves through you. The Methodists were a little low-key. The Baptists down the road were a bit
Baptist,
more
rambunctious. Baptists, I'm going to say that sounds like, yeah. And I'm thinking about the difference between the masculine and the feminine ideas of what wholeness is and what the divine is. And I think sometimes we fear, oh, if I go around into this wholeness and I keep talking about it, that's just a feminization of creativity and a feminization of connection to God. And I think what you're talking about in some ways is a masculine, and I think masculinity is very much important in this and part of it. I mean, you think of Odysseus going out. He's not staying home with Penelope and weaving on the loom and then unraveling the loom, the weaving. He's going out. And I think that also, though, is a search for wholeness, that it's not just a feminine thing. It's a very... And I don't want to say this is male and this is female, but there is a certain just generating of energy and power that is important, well, I think to every human being, that comes about through this kind of connection.
Well, I'm certainly coming at it through the male lens
yeah.
here. I identify with Ulysses, and I know a lot of my male friends who we talk like this. We not that many, but I do have some friends that carry this on. They come with a male lens, mm-hmm. and they ask some of these same kind of questions I'm asking. And yet when we talk together, there's an intimacy there.
Yeah.
There's a connection there. It's not superficial at all.
Right.
Caring, deep love, respect, all of that, more centered in the masculine.
Mm-hmm.
And yet this idea of masculine and feminine, it cuts across many species. Some species don't have it. And then we move beyond the earth into the other dimensions. I don't even know if it exists out there. Something's there that balances us out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just really a delightful thing. And I've also looked down at my clock and I see that we're almost at the end of our time together. And I mean, well, what is infinity? But for us, we have an hour to work with. So we've covered some tremendous ground.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd love for you to just take this moment to sorbet the last bit of our time together. And how are you feeling right now in your body? Coming back to the questions that I started out with. We ended the writing workshop. How do you feel now? How do you feel right now? You are aware of what?
Well, I am aware of the power. I love these conversations because they connect me, but they also connect me to ideas that are bigger than me. I am incredibly thankful for the week that we spent together, because I think as you have talked about, it's a way into that power. Maybe not the power of a conversation between two people, but the power that ignites that conversation. And I think that's what I'm thankful for. I'm thankful for you because of that, but I'm also thankful because this past week has outlined for me or circumscribed for me or shown me that the power that gives rise to ideas and connection and writing.
I think we've wrapped up for now, but it's never, ever enough. I think you will agree. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
And there you go, my friends. Thus concludes my conversation with Diana Gustafson. I enjoyed my conversation with Diana quite a bit. We started our conversation in Taos, where I recorded it, as you already know. Now I'm finishing the editing in Paris. I'm here visiting my buddy, John Van Hassel. We've known each other for many years. I flew over from Albuquerque to Salt Lake City via Delta Airlines to Paris yesterday. Bit on the jet-laggy side, but wide awake. The room is sunny. I'm sitting at a round table with a checkered red tablecloth, red and white tablecloth. It's been a real pleasure to edit the conversation. That's because I get to listen to it again. I do like the intellectual romps in conversations like this, and I hope you got something out of it, too. So on that note, I will say thank you ever so much for tuning in to Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I'm your host, James Nave. Thank you, Devin Dial, for managing WPVM-FM in Asheville, Robin Collier and Mike Tilley for doing the same at KCEI-FM Cultural Energy Radio in Taos. I bumped into Robin Collier outside of SIDS the other day. He was fundraising for for KCEI. So we had a long conversation about radio towers and land grants. It's good to see Robin out there raising money in front of the health food store. Good place to be. Walter Parks, thank you ever so much for providing us with our theme song. I appreciate it so much. WalterParks.com for more on Walter's music. And I'd like to remind you that every Saturday, my creative collaborator, Allegra Houston, and I host a Zoom 1-hour imaginative storm writing gathering. We generate a piece of writing and we read it aloud. The door is open for anyone who wants to join us. You can find out more about that at jamesnave.com. Nave spelled N-A-V-E. It's a community of writers. People come from all over the place. Sometimes they call in from France, where I am right now. Some people call in from Asheville. We've got a fair number of people who call in from Taos, where this show airs. So it's a collection, really good collection of folks. You can learn more, as I said, at jamesnave.com. And so on that note, I think that pretty much brings us to the end of the show. And I will say goodbye in a moment. But before I do, since we did talk about the Garden of Eden and we talked about Adam and Eve, I'd like to tag on to the end of our time a fabulous song that's been rearranged by Big John Scherer. You know the song. It's titled Nature Boy, Nature Girl. He combines the Adam and Eve story into a great song. So on that note, thanks again for listening. I hope you come back sometime soon. And until then, maybe I'll catch you on that turnaround somewhere down the line.
Rock and roll generation have never found ourselves defining first rock and roll song. Host Jamie DeLappa presents music and musicians you've never heard who pioneered rock and roll. Songs that could have been the first rock and roll song. Songs that fill the gap in understanding where we came from and who we are today. Saturday afternoons at 2 here on Radio Asheville.
Thank you for tuning in to WPVMLP Asheville, North Carolina, 103.7. Streaming online, WPVMFM.org. The voice of Asheville, heard all over the world.
From Feature Story News in the UK, I'm John Bieber. The UK's governing Labour Party has seen huge losses in local elections. It's causing renewed speculation about a leadership challenge against Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer. But he says he's going nowhere.
We were right to emphasise to the country the difficult inheritance we've had, the challenges we face, but we haven't done enough to convince people that things can improve, their lives can get better.